listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, August 21st, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Coming up this hour, we chat with University of Alaska Southeast Chancellor Dr. Aparna Palmer about new student orientation, as well as the zero-cost textbook initiative. It's the 34th year of the Beat the Odds race from Cancer Connection. It's happening this Saturday. We'll have a preview. And today, we're going to start with a little triple resonance. That's a little bit of Brahms, and that is going to be Triple Resonance, which is the title of the upcoming concert from the Orpheus Project focused on the chamber music of Brahms. It's this Sunday, August 24th at 2 p.m., and there is no admission charge. And I have two guests today from the concert who will be representing the concert, and that is, first of all, W. Todd Hunt, who's the artistic director of Orpheus Project. Ganesh for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Todd. And Annika Kravchik, who is playing the cello, who is interneting in from Sitka audio-wise. Can you hear us, Annika?
Hello, yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, Gunath Cheesh for being here. That is so great. How's Sitka over there today?
It's a beautiful day. Yeah, it's quite lovely. We played this same concert last night, and it was a beautiful day all day, and then it rained just as the concert started, which is exactly what we musicians hope for.
Perfect. That's so interesting. So wait a second, Todd. You're saying you took this concert over Sitka.
Mm-hmm. It was actually the original idea for this. Doug Smith, who was playing piano for this, wanted to do a concert in Sitka. And so he was trying to get me to play like this giant clarinet and piano recital. And I was like, oh, you know, if we're going to Sitka, I know there's a really good cellist who lives there and we should use her and we should do the Brahms Trio. And he was like, okay, sure. And I got to lighten my load a little bit there because Annika is going to play a piece on her own as well. So
I see. Okay. Yeah, and I'm going to put the poster up that we have for this weekend's concert. Again, it's Sunday, August 24th at 2 p.m. So what does it mean, the chamber music of Brahms? What are you including in this program?
Okay, so basically, I mean, I could have really described what it was, but that would be way too long for a little tagline. Because Brahms wrote a lot of chamber music. So the chamber music that we're doing is half of the chamber music for clarinet that Brahms wrote, which is very late in his life, as well as a relatively early piece, the Sonata for Cello and Piano in E minor, which is kind of a fun contrast for us nerds to listen to early
classical music.
Early Brahms versus really late Brahms. I mean, this is like 2 or 3 years before his death. And he had actually quit composing and heard a clarinetist play who he ended up admiring so much, he came out of retirement to write four pieces for him.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's what I was going to ask, is how did he get to writing clarinet so late in life? So he met somebody and got
and
inspired.
Was inspired.
Wow.
By his playing. And wrote two clarinet sonatas, a trio, which we're going to play together, Anakai and Doug, as well as a quintet, so a string quartet plus a clarinet, which I've never done. It'll be the one thing left on the Brahms list for me.
Checking it all off.
Right.
I love that. And there's no charge for this.
Right, yeah, just by donation, or, you know, if you don't got any cash on you, that's fine. Come on in.
How do you do
how does
that?
This work? Well, you know, we are very well supported by our Arts Council and, you know, other community foundation, and definitely our local donors, just individual donors, have been fantastic for us. And this is not a very expensive concert, too. So
it's basically because you and Doug Smith, who's playing piano, you live here in Juneau.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Annika lives over in Sitka, so it's hopping her on the plane and getting her over here with her cello.
It's actually, pretty easy. And we're at Kunekhidi Northern Light United Church, which is one of my favorite places to play in town.
It's
and,
beautiful
and
they sound are, in there, I bet.
And they are very reasonable with their rates.
And it's at 2 o'clock.
At 2 o'clock this Sunday.
Okay. Annika, I want to talk to you for a sec. What is your relationship to the cello? How did that begin for you?
Oh man, I started playing cello in fourth grade, really got into it at the end of high school and ended up, I did 3 years in one high school. In my final year, I went to an arts boarding school in Northern Michigan called Interlochen.
Oh yeah.
And then from there, I ended up going to Oberlin and did the whole double degree thing. So I majored in cello performance as well as history and Russian. And really all of those things ended up landing me in Sitka because I first came to Sitka for the Sitka Cello Seminar, which is run by the music festival here. And I was interested in Sitka because of the Russian history here. So it was really destiny. and then I ended up playing with the Juneau Symphony in 2023, which is how I met Todd.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting because you said all the key words there, Interlochen, Oberlin, like... Just in terms,
yeah,
it feels like those are the. It feels like those are all the paths to being a cellist for life, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also Oberlin has a lot of crazy ties with Sitka. There's I call Sitka sleeper Obi town because it's kind of a similar size, similar love for music and the arts here, similar love of food. Just slightly different environment between Ohio and Alaska.
How long have you been over there in Sitka?
I moved here full-time just over a year ago, but I have been coming up pretty much every summer since 2018.
I see.
And I spent a summer in Juneau working for Earth Justice back in 2023.
And so you made the decision to move to Sitka full-time. What made that decision for you? Just the love of the area?
Yeah, I just fell in love. Fell in love with Sitka, fell in love with the idea that in a small town, you can really kind of plug in and be helpful with whatever talents you have. So my day job is being a public interest attorney for Sitka Tribe of Alaska. And then I get to be a cellist by night. So I feel like there's not too many places in the world where you get to have it all like that.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, like, I know that obviously there's the, you know, Sitka seems to be, you know, it's our sister city here in Juneau, and the arts seem to be so vibrant in these small towns in the Southeast communities, and Sitka, especially for music, I think it seems like there's a lot of music there. So do you keep yourself busy? You're staying busy with the cello?
Oh, for sure. I have to kind of go to Juneau to get my hankering for classical music covered, but there's a lot of bluegrass and folk music happening in Sitka, especially during the school year. So I've been kind of breaking into more improv and playing away from the page. So actually it's always interesting to come back to doing classical music and having to read read music and notice, oh yeah, that muscle's atrophying a little bit if I don't practice that.
Well, we're excited to have you come this weekend. Todd, can you tell us a little bit more about, you mentioned how this sort of came about with Doug had this idea, and then you said you knew Annika, and you're like getting all this. What is special about the chamber music of Brahms?
Well, it is very, how do I put it? On one hand, it's very cerebral, but on the other hand, it's very passionate. And putting those two together, and actually for him having written pieces for clarinet, which I have been studying a lot more rigorously in the past few years, coming from saxophone,
who has interesting.
That Brahms didn't write anything for the saxophone, which is such a shame, I think. So I am kind of reveling in being able to play this glorious music. But I think the program we've got is nice. Like I mentioned before, we've got some early Brahms and some late Brahms. And I think one of the things you'll notice is you can hear the youth and the vitality and the sometimes like even the ego of a, you know, a young, fantastic composer. And then compare that with the clarinet sonata and the trio, which are very late in life, and just how kind of perfectly balanced and beautifully written and conceived everything is. I just think it's fantastic.
Are you playing them in age order?
No, we're not. One of the reasons is, so the sonata I'm playing is on one clarinet and the trio is on another. And so we're kind of bookending the young Brahms in the middle, which is the cello sonata. So I have a chance to change instruments and get it.
I see. Okay, yep. I see. And what about you, Annika? How do you feel about this Brahms, especially the sonata that you're going to be featured on?
Yeah, the Brahms cello sonata is a piece that I've been aware of for a long time. A lot of cellists play it. I played it back at Interlochen. and I actually shared a story at the concert last night of I've played it once for my dog, and he just hated the key of E minor, and he would just howl anytime I played the Brahms cello sonata or the Elgar cello sonata, cello concerto, also in E minor. So it's been fun to come back to the piece, like really 10 years later, and discover new things about it. And like Todd was saying, you really can hear the youth of the piece. He wrote it when he was 33. I'm 28 now. The bravado of the piano part is so hard.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous,
and
yes.
So dense, and so the cello is often like fighting for its life to peek out of the texture, and I think that's just a function of Brahms was a really amazing pianist. And there's a story that I was reading researching this piece of the cellist that he wrote it for. They were reading it together for the first time, and he's like, "Hey, Brahms, I can hardly hear myself." And Brahms said, "Well, you're lucky."
That's funny. Well, it sounds like a wonderful concert. It sounds like it's going to be a wonderful Sunday afternoon. It's over at the Konecki Northern Light United Church. It's 2:00, August 24th. That's this Sunday. There is no admission.
Yeah.
You can donate at the door if you'd
like. We'd love that, of course. On the website, orpheusproject.org.
Yes.
If you want to pay it ahead or, you know, pay it later too,
or
that's all good.
Learn more about Orpheus Project. Mm-hmm. This one's called Triple Resonance Chamber Music of Brahms. And what's up next for Orpheus Project?
The next thing is Acoustic Turbulence.
Ooh, that
I just
sounds
love,
good.
Like, these fun names we've got this season. And it will be a choreographed with new music and poetry projections. And everything, all sort of centering around the bumblebee.
Oh, that's so great. Well, yeah. Annika Gunath-Cheesh, for joining us. Appreciate you being here. Todd Gunath-Cheesh, for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Boston.
And have a great concert on Sunday. Yep. Really appreciate
thanks
it.
You're so much.
Thank you, Annika. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We'll hear a little bit more of That Brahms. That Brahms, that Brahms, that Brahms.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Cuisteach U, Bill Fawcett. And the word this week is chas.
Chas.
That means pink salmon or humpy. And here's a sentence. The humpy really flowed along. Let's hear it again.
Chas.
Pink salmon or humpy. Gunashjisht Khune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska at Southeast for this audio.
Cuisteach U Ish Bill Fawcett was Slúchadh Atí and the child of a southern Tishoni man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsíchua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Akquan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Bird Note. On a hot summer's day, you can watch a bird, like a crow, very, very carefully, and you'll never see it sweat, because birds don't have sweat glands. Instead, they've evolved a variety of other ways to keep cool. One of them is panting. As the bird breathes rapidly, its throat quivering, heat is carried out of the body via the lungs and air sacs. The lungs are a one-way system, so cool air coming in does not get mixed up with warm air coming out. Holding its bill open, the bird also oscillates a tiny bone in a part of its throat where there are a lot of blood vessels. The oscillations bring more blood to the area, allowing heat from the blood to dissipate. Bare skin on the legs, face, and beak also help the cooling. So do puffing out feathers, fluttering wings, or splashing in a puddle or bird bath. And soaring birds, like hawks, can simply ride the updrafts far above the ground to where the air is cooler. Closer to the ground, birds can also do what we do to avoid overheating. Keep busy during cooler hours and take it easy in the shade as the day heats up. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on the live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Wherever you are, that's where we want to be. Beat the Odds, a race against cancer, is an annual fundraiser from Cancer Connection. It's happening this Saturday, August 23rd at 9 a.m. It's a 5K run and a 2-mile walk. They've got all kinds of things in store, and it'll be a fundraiser, which will help Southeast Alaskans who are facing cancer. And I have with me in the studio to tell us a little bit more about it, I have founding board member Ruth Johnson. Gunachish Wasaiyati, Ruth, how are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Excellent. Welcome back to the show. And I have board president Cheryl Weinberg. Gunachish Wasaiyati, Cheryl.
Good afternoon. Happy to be here.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So I was looking at this because Beat the Odds, this thing is in its 34th year, Ruth. How long has Cancer Connection been around?
Well, this event does predate us.
Oh, it does?
Yeah,
okay,
I was wondering. It started with one woman who came home from a pretty bad diagnosis and treatment and decided she wanted to help other women facing breast cancer diagnosis in her community. So she started the race. It became too big for her and her husband, and Glacier Valley Rotary took it over and then eventually passed on event management to us.
I see. Okay. Yeah,
because so
I
was like, we've been doing it about 20 years maybe.
Yeah, because I thought, isn't Cancer Connection like 30 years or so?
Yeah.
So you guys are in your, somewhere around that zone? And I was like, so this has been a long time, this event. It's got a history here in Juneau. Tell us a little bit about why this event is so important, Cheryl.
Well, it is our one fundraiser of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important because with the funds, we do a number of things. And probably most importantly is if a person has a cancer diagnosis and they have need to travel, and that could be travel to Juneau because we have a lot of services here now, or it could be travel out of town, we have a travel fund that is supported by the funds that we raise at this event. And so people can apply through their doctor's referral for up to $750 a year to help with that those expenses. And for many, that's really a lifeline. And then we also, related to travel to Seattle, we maintain and support an apartment that is available for people who have a diagnosis and need treatment. And that's an apartment that if people have the ability to pay and our rate is way below market. And so we subsidize the cost of people staying there. And we also do other things with the funds, but the importance of the race in terms of fundraising really can't be discounted.
So, and that's important because I know some people have to, the Cancer Care Center down there in Seattle, there's other things mm-hmm. around Seattle as well, but having that apartment, and because sometimes people have to be there for extended periods of time. They may not necessarily be inpatient, right? So they need to be outpatient,
Absolutely.
But go to a lot of appointments and stuff over the coming weeks. And so that's a pretty vital service that Cancer Connection does.
Mm-hmm.
You can check out cancerconnectionak.org for all the things that Cancer Connection does. You can also get information on this race in particular at cancerconnectionak.org/BTO, beat the odds. So Ruth, what's happening this weekend?
Well, we're going to have a race, and for the third year in a row, we were threatened by that flood. So it's been a tricky place to host a race for the last 3 years. And this year, in fact, the Brotherhood Bridge Trail is closed. But we have a rock star race director from Juneau Trail and Roadrunners, Kim Mosseth, and she has put many miles on her bike. And we've completely rerouted. We've actually switched the direction of the runners and walkers this year, and the runners are going to be doing what used to be our walking course, and it's been somewhat extended. They're going to end up at Wild Meadow and on a trail that goes to Carl Reiches Boulevard, and they're going to do an out and back that goes from Diamond Park out over the bridge. The walkers used to go that way out to Vintage Park and back, but we just don't have access to even the pedestrian bridge over the river is closed from Diamond Park this year. So the walkers are not actually going to leave the Diamond Park Thunder Mountain area. We have a 2-mile route for them coming and going from the Riverbend Cuxtegiwihu School covered play area. And so the walkers are going to be staying a little bit close to home. The runners are taking over the walk route. And that will make sense to people who've done it for some of them close to those 30 years.
Yeah, how many runners do you usually have? I mean runners and walkers, like participants. How many people participate in the event?
The last few years, it's between 300 and 350. About a third of them are runners. Yeah,
that's amazing. I'm always amazed at the runners because, well, just anybody. They these races always start so early. They get up and they go. You know, I love that. And so where is it at again? Where's the starting point?
Riverbend School.
Okay.
And it's in the covered play area. And we'll do a little bit of speaking about Cancer Connection at the beginning of the event. And then Kim Mosseth, the race director, will take the stage and she will have detailed maps drawn out for everybody.
Mm.
The course will also be well marked and we'll have volunteers along the way to direct people. But she'll tell everyone to go. And then I think she's going to take the runners out of the covered area to a starting point somewhere in Diamond Park that I'm absolutely not certain where it is right now, but she knows where it is.
Right. But you all, well, everybody would meet at the River Bend.
Everyone meets in the covered play area.
I see. Okay. And other things that are happening, Cheryl, not just racers and walkers, what else is going on?
Well, to start with, people will probably start showing up 8:30-ish to register, and we'll have coffee, and we'll have fruit and granola bars so people can visit. It's very social. And then we also have, after the race, when people come back, well, as they register, the first 200 folks who registered will be picking up their T-shirt. Shoefly has donated some certificates, some discount certificates. They'll be able to pick that up too. As runners return, they get some socks, and those were donated by Nugget NAO. And then when a good number of the people have returned, then we start an outcry auction. We have three great auction items. One includes an Alaska Airlines round trip ticket, anywhere they go.
Oh, nice.
We also have a guided kayaking trip. And then we have a helicopter trip over the glaciers donated by North Star. And then we have door prizes. We'll be announcing door prizes. And I think Ruth said we're up at 50 door prizes. And we have great door prizes from the generous community.
Wow.
So that's always fun.
Well, I think you also mentioned, you touched on something, Cheryl, which I think is really great. And I think it's the opportunity to, A, support Cancer Connection, right? To be able to, if you're a runner or a walker and you want to be part of that. But then also the sense of community that is created. People who might be cancer survivors, there might be people who have family members who had cancer or have cancer. So Ruth, can you speak to that a little bit in terms of how important is that sense of community to this kind of event?
Well, we get a lot of feedback from people. For instance, I was at the support group meeting this week, and one of the participants said, I'm going to be so sad to miss it. I've been to so many of them even before I was a cancer survivor myself. And so I know for a lot of people, well, one, a lot of people are proud of the fact they have all of the T-shirts.
It's like the KTO mugs. Exactly.
But yeah, no, there's a lot of people in the cancer community that come together, families to support people currently in treatment, to support people who survived, and to honor people who we've lost to cancer.
Yeah.
We always have little memorial hearts that people can put the name of a loved one on and wear in memory or in honor of someone they've lost.
That's so nice.
And people have started bringing teams or creating teams to support people who are going through treatment. And just to support the event, we had the Hula Halau wore skirts last year. There was another big group from Delta Western who they were supporting one of their staff people. So that sense of community, I think, is really unique at this event.
Yeah.
You know, and the other community piece of it about this event that I love is the people. I mean, there's only 10 people on our board, or 8 or 9, I don't know how many we are right now. But the volunteers who help us out to do this event feel a real sense of ownership. Mm-hmm. And I have to put, LG Rayfield's been doing registration for us for, years and years, since before since Cancer Connection took it over. The mammographers who daringly refer to themselves as the Boob Squad have been handling the T-shirts for us. So we have professional accountants, professional x-ray technician, the mammographers from Bartlett. We have Super Bear providing the snacks, the Grind providing coffee, the Coast Guard, the fire department shows up with volunteers. So like if we need extra volunteers on the trail to direct the runners and walkers on our new course, we have this great core group of businesses and people. Oh, and I got a shout out to Charlie Williams at Valley Paint, who hangs all the banners of our sponsors.
And Keith Giles, who does the sound system.
Yeah.
A real community effort come together.
Yeah,
to
they help
this
us
event
every
happen.
Year, year after year. Oh, Alaska Commercial Contractors, Jason Murdoch and his crew put up our stage. And
wow.
Yeah.
34 years. It's a long time. Mm-hmm. For an event. I love it, though. I love that it continues to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some other pamphlets there. What are those about?
Well, I just wanted to mention, in addition to some of the other things that we do, Ruth mentioned the support group. And so we have a support group once a month, the third Tuesday. And we have moved that group to the Radiation Oncology Center. They're graciously hosting us. And it's a lovely, you know, it sounds odd, but it is a lovely environment. It's very calm. It's very peaceful. And it's a great place to get folks together who need to talk and want to talk about where they are in their journey. Some people are 30 years out and a survivor, and other people are newly diagnosed and in the midst of treatment. We also, we're revitalizing a program called Let's Talk, which is a peer mentoring program. We've updated the curriculum. We've had some people that have been trained to be a peer mentor. And we're actually, at some point in the fall, we're going to be having a volunteer training. So we can do matching of people to who are wanting a buddy with somebody who has walked in similar shoes, who's willing to spend some time and help with the navigation and of their experience. So we have a brochure. We're going to be updating the brochure about Let's Talk. I'm happy to leave it with you.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Yeah.
And where can people find out? Can they find out about both of these things on the website as well?
They can.
Okay.
They can. We host that website. We also have an office manager. So if somebody wants to call instead of email us or contact us through the web, they can get in touch with our office manager, and she can help to match them with whatever it is they're needing.
Okay, that's great. You can just give them a call. Can you give the phone number?
Yes. 907-796-2273.
2273. I love it.
Yeah, I just have it in my phone.
Yeah, I know, right? Everybody's probably got it memorized.
I had to read it. I'm glad I brought it.
But for those who may not access the interwebs, which is, you can go to cancerconnectionak.org for that information. And also you can go there for information on this Beat the Odds, a race against cancer. Registration is online only, it says on the flyer here. And is it cut off at a certain point, Ruth?
No. No, Corey's gonna.
Okay.
He's gonna
run it right up to the end.
Right up to the end.
Right up to the end, and we'll have QR codes at the event, and the LG Rayfield accountants. You can register in person day of event also.
So you can show up at 8:30.
You can show up at 8:30.
The race starts at 9, right?
Yeah.
Can I mention one other thing?
Yeah,
really
please.
Quickly. So I want to also give a shout out to the Alaska Brewing Company. They have identified us as their nonprofit of the year.
Oh, nice.
And so they allowed us to have a booth there for the last three Saturdays. If people want to go to the tasting room and leave a tip, all the proceeds will go to Cancer Connection. And that's another great example of we didn't seek them out. They sought us out. And
that's
we're
fantastic.
Delighted.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And that is Beat the Odds, a race against cancer, the 34th annual 5K run or a 2-mile walk. It's this Saturday, August 23rd at 9 a.m. You can register online via this link you can see here, or you can go to cancerconnectionak.org/BTO. And you can still register in person on the day. It even says that right there on the flyer. So for all you last-minute runner junkies who don't get it registered, I'm Cheryl Weinberg, Ruth Johnson. Thank you so much, Gunthchish, for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Boston.
This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Here's a little more Brahms.
sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
A father and son are hunting Sitka black-tailed deer on Kodiak Island, and they spot a large buck. Kodiak Island is renowned for producing big deer. The majority of Alaska's biggest black-tailed deer have been harvested on Kodiak Island, and deer aren't even native to Kodiak. All those deer on Kodiak are from a source population of just 24 animals. Most of those were from, you guessed it, Sitka, on Baranof Island in southeast Alaska, transplanted to Kodiak about 100 years ago. At that time, Sitka was pretty much at the northern edge of the natural range of black-tailed deer. In 1924, 14 deer from Sitka were released on Long Island, adjacent to Kodiak Island. 6 years later, 2 deer from Prince of Wales Island were transplanted. The population did not seem to be thriving, so in 1934, 9 deer were captured near Petersburg and transplanted to Kodiak. Then the population grew steadily, and legal hunting began in 1953, when 34 deer were harvested. By the late 1960s, deer had spread to adjacent Afognak Island, and the population was thriving. The harvest in 1967 was 1,500 deer. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Hanson Gress, ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk anachaya ha anikach. Gunnish cheese.
Listening to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. A new semester begins. Perhaps it's your first one. How do you navigate those first days of college? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Aparna Palmer, Chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast, with some good news on that front and some welcoming events for new students, and I'm assuming returning students as well. But Dr. Palmer, gunachish, wasi iti, how are you today?
Ah, gunachish, and thank you for having me here today. We are very, very excited about the start of the fall semester. Classes start on Monday, which is so exciting. And today, we actually had some new students move into our dorms. So it was such an exciting day on campus today.
That moving day, you know, especially for freshmen, you know, that first time maybe out of the house, mm-hmm. like getting their own place. And yep. I know they share some rooms there and stuff, right? You share a dorm room and stuff. And is it required for freshmen to live on campus or no?
Well, we generally ask students that are coming from other communities to live on campus. But if you live in the Juneau community, you can inquire about living at home and coming to school.
I see. I know, because some colleges require you to be on campus because that transition from high school living at home to college and all that freedom that you might have can sometimes get some students in trouble.
Well, it is nice to live on campus. And I will tell you that when I was applying for colleges, I would have been perfectly happy to live at home. And my mother said no. She said, you're going to go out there. You're going to learn how to live with different people. You're going to learn how to be independent. It'll be a great experience. We want you to live in a dorm. So I lived there.
It's socializing too, right? It's learning how to socialize and be on your own and figure out how to have that sense of responsibility and all that.
It is. It is very, very powerful. But I'm also respectful of students who want to be at home. I understand that you know, they may have some responsibilities at home, and of course, they may want the support of living at home. So either way, we welcome our students, but it is a great experience to live in the dorm.
I love that. And you said school starts on Monday, but you have a sheet over there that has a multitude of events that are happening before Monday.
Yeah.
So let's run through that and talk about some of these cool things that are coming up. Is it kind of like to get people warmed up to being on campus and such?
Exactly. Warmed up to being on campus, warmed up to the experience of going to college, especially for our newest students. This year we have about 250 students who are either first-time freshmen or transfer students coming to start their year at UAS. Many of them moved in today.
Wow.
And so over the weekend, we have a number of activities. So tomorrow, they will have student convocation, which is our way of welcoming them and helping orient them to the different services that are available on the Juneau campus. We talk about financial aid. We talk about how to budget. We also talk about mental health issues and how to take care of yourself and how to seek help if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Sunday, we're taking our students downtown so that they can see our fabulous downtown here in Juneau, which, in my humble opinion, is one of the best downtowns in the world.
I love Juneau downtown. Yeah.
It is amazing. We're also going to have a bonfire and do s'mores. Sunday, we're going to go whale watching and spend some time on the lake. And then Monday, even after classes begin, both in the morning and in the afternoon, we will be leading hikes out to Nugget Falls near the Mendenhall Glacier. So we're really excited about all of those activities.
How many students are there that come from outside of Juneau?
So, most of our students are from Southeast Alaska, but we also get students from all over Alaska, and about 10 to 15% of our incoming class comes from other states.
Other states, okay.
Yeah.
I figured there was a lot of Southeast representation.
Yeah.
I didn't realize maybe, because I know there's University of Alaska Anchorage.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an alumni of that.
Yeah.
There's also UAF up in, Fairbanks. And,
yep, we had people from Fairbanks checking in today, people from Anchorage. There was people from Kodiak.
Wow.
People from a little village near Nome. So lots of really interesting areas.
Because there's some specialty programs that UAS offers that maybe aren't at the other colleges, right?
Well, definitely some unique programs. A lot of students come to us because we have an amazing marine biology program and an amazing environmental sciences program. I also met a student today who's here so that she can become a teacher. So those are some of our more popular programs. We also have a student who's going to start in our brand new behavioral health program.
Mm.
And so we're excited about that as well.
Yeah, I think you told us about the behavioral health program a couple months back, yeah?
Yeah, we're so, so excited. I think it'll serve a really important need for the state of Alaska. And, if you think about our graduates, 87% of them in general, if they graduate from UAS, stay in Alaska and are employed within 1 year of graduation.
Wow.
And if they come in from out of state, that number is about 71%. So, if you have a child who goes to the University of Alaska, they tend to stay in Alaska and contribute to our workforce. And when we have students who come from outside of Alaska, a huge percentage of them stay in Alaska and contribute to our economy.
It's the classic story. You come to Alaska for school, you come for a summer job, and all of a sudden, you're a lifer. That's how it works.
Well, it is absolutely beautiful here.
Yeah.
I still look out my window at the university and think, I live in the most beautiful place on earth. Southeast Alaska is spectacular.
When did you start?
About 2 years ago.
Are we coming up on 2 years? Wow, that's amazing. Well, we know that people come from around the state, even locally, and maybe from out of state, and it's not cheap to go to school. And you have something that I find really fascinating, something called the Zero Textbook Initiative. What is that?
Yeah, so this is an initiative that is a nationwide initiative.
Okay.
And many universities participate in it. UAS started participating in this initiative in 2022. So essentially what it is taking the exorbitant textbook costs and thinking about how we can educate our students at the same high level with either a lower cost or even zero cost.
Yeah.
And so since 2022, faculty at UAS have worked really hard to develop classroom materials that in many cases cost the student nothing, but they're just as rigorous, they're just as informative, and in fact can be more creative, more inclusive. And they have adopted them. And so this year, since the start of the Zero Cost Initiative, we have saved students over $1 million.
Whoa.
So
yeah, I remember when I was going to UAA, we didn't have PDFs, you know, back in my day. We didn't have that option. And I remember it felt like most of my Alaska student loan was going towards books. And I always tried to figure out, like, why are textbooks so much more expensive? And I feel like it's because they can be, and because they're printed on the same materials as other things, other books that you can buy at a store and whatnot. And so, you know, we had like used book sales. You could get your biology book or something. Maybe you could get something because somebody didn't want to keep that for life kind of thing. But I would spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on textbooks.
I did too. And, you know, nowadays, with the high cost of living, sometimes students are making the choice between buying a textbook and buying their next meal.
Right.
We don't want to have them make that choice.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we offer an education as much as possible where students can, you know, pay attention to the things that matter most, invest their money there, not have to worry so much about textbook costs. And so this is a really, really important initiative, I think, for the entire nation. And I'm really, really proud that UAS began this in 2022, and we, since then, we have saved students this much money.
Yeah, $1 million, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You bring up something that I just thought of, so I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but because most things are online, I'm also curious if the university is investigating or talking about AI at all. Because what I'm hearing in the zeitgeist is, oh, students are using AI to write their papers. And is there stuff, what's happening with that?
So AI is really important as a phenomenon in education, particularly at the college and university level.
Yeah.
And so the entire University of Alaska system has actually groups of faculty that are working together to really think about how AI can be used in a productive way in student learning experiences. And even at UAS, you know, when you think about our writing professors are really aware that AI is here to stay in terms of how it helps students write. And so they are working on helping their students use it as a tool. Because AI, without the critical thinking that a person brings to AI, can sometimes make no sense at all. And so really teaching students that it is a tool, but it's not a replacement for their ability to think critically about things is very important.
That's the thing I feel like most people are concerned with, is that we're losing the critical thinking skills. Obviously, I feel like using AI to, you know, if you get a 200-page research PDF and you use AI to parse some of that down to the main points of it, that then you can think about critically in terms of writing your paper. But the ones that are using AI to plug that into and then write the paper, I'm imagining that the professors are also getting keen on noticing that, or there's things that you can run it through to say, hey, this is probably not written by a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. Professors are able to detect when students are using AI instead of really engaging with the material. But I think, you know, this is a challenge. This is something that we really, this is a kind of a technology that we have to learn how to work with. And, you know, I think it is the responsibility of a university to teach students how to think critically about things so that they can examine all of the information out there, including information provided by AI, and really be able to tell what is reliable, accurate information and what is not, which is becoming more and more challenging these days.
I used to teach theater. And I thought about this in the sense of, I'm just thinking about it now, but like the idea that maybe perhaps future education in the classroom goes back to, you know, the oral report or having a question and answer with a student to really glean whether they have learned the information as opposed to them writing an essay about it, because that's so much easier to possibly fake, whereas the knowledge, if you're having to engage in a conversation about a topic, and it could change the way education is done, which I think is kind of interesting.
I think that is interesting. I think at a smaller university like UAS, where we really want that tight student-faculty ratio, that low ratio, I think it's much easier for faculty to really help students use AI appropriately, but also to be able to discern when AI is being used inappropriately.
Right.
And also really communicating to our students that your brain doesn't grow if you don't challenge it. And so when right. you're faced with a challenge, give it a try.
Now, that is so great. And I do love the one-on-one. There's a little bit more one-on-one between faculty and students out at UAS because the class sizes are usually a little bit smaller, which is awesome. And speaking of challenging the brain, last time you were here, we were talking about, we'd been talking about over the time the tardigrades and the polychaetes, and then you said, no, but the onomorphins, how do you say it?
The onocophorins.
The onocophorins. You said the onocophorins are out there, and you left me with that. And I was like, the onocophorins are out there. What do I do with that? So I had to do my own research and try to figure it out. And I found out that these are called velvet worms.
Yes.
They're typically found in moist environments such as rainforests.
Yep.
But they're not necessarily in Alaska. They appreciate more of the southern hemisphere. Am I right about this?
Yeah.
Do I get an A? No, I'm just kidding. But tell me a little bit about these
things. You get an A.
Thank you.
These are typically found in tropical, humid environments.
Mm.
And there is a group of them that are found all over the world in tropical environments. And then there's a group that's more restricted to the southern hemisphere, just as you mentioned.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. They are amazing. I've had a chance to see them in life when I've taken students to Ecuador and other South American countries. They are these little caterpillar-like organisms, but when you look at them up close, you realize they're not caterpillars at all.
Mm.
They have all of these legs, and they have a very different sort of shaped head that doesn't look like an insect. And the coolest thing, they have slime sac glands.
Okay, tell me about slime sac glands.
Yeah. So right near their mouth, they have these glands that they use to deliver a huge, what I would call a huge amount of slime for a really small organism that's about caterpillar size, onto their prey.
Oh.
And they disable their prey using those slime, the slime, and then they have these like jaws that they use to basically ingest the prey organism.
Wow. That's amazing.
I always think that we need children's books about organisms like onychophorans because they are amazing.
Yeah, and they look fantastic. You can put it in your favorite search engine, velvet worms, because onychophorans is really difficult to spell. But you just put in velvet worms and you'll see a little research on them. They're really interesting, and they have. I want to learn more about this, but they have, in terms of evolutionary research, they have importance in that, which is kind of interesting. But I didn't know. I didn't learn about the slime. That's so fascinating.
Well, I'm an invertebrate zoologist, and slime and mucus are things that I feel very close to.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to just enjoy them so much. And that's, you're a marine biologist, right? That's where you kind of studied, and that is one of the great programs out at UAS, although I know you don't get to teach much anymore because you're busy running the organization.
I don't get to teach much, but imagine my surprise. Mm. A couple of weeks ago, a student came up to me and said, can we look for tardigrades together?
Oh, that's so great.
Later this semester, I'm going to get together with this student. We're going to collect some habitat where tardigrades could live, and this will be my first foray since I got here into seeing what kind of tardigrades live in Southeast Alaska.
That is so fantastic. Yeah, I want to hear a report on that next time you join us. I know we're going to be having a lot of UAS interaction this fall because of the Evening at Egan series, so we'll be featuring highlights of those each week. But we'll still hear from Dr. Aparna Palmer throughout the fall as well. It's always a pleasure to have you in here. Thank you for challenging me in terms of my invertebrates knowledge, because I don't have any. But I really appreciate you being here. And this weekend, all the events you can find, you can go to uas.alaska.edu. There's probably a calendar on there that has some of these events on there for new students.
Yeah. Not too late to register for classes if you're interested. So
classes start Monday. Get on it, folks.
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr.
Thank
Palmer.
You.
Really appreciate you being here.
All right. Bye-bye.
Going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, we have a preview of the upcoming panel discussion next Tuesday about the changes to federal health care coverage. You don't want to miss that conversation. We'll also have a preview of the upcoming Harvest Festival. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you, never more important than now. And Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Lisa Purvis and Aaron Tripp. Gunith Cheesh, have a lovely Juno evening. And you can hop on over to our sister station at KXLL 100.7 and 101.7 to hang out with DJ Kelly as she rocks some tunes this afternoon. Every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday from 4 to 5 over on KXLL. Gunith Cheesh!